The final performance of Porgy and Bess is September 23rd, so before time runs out, we're listening back to interviews with a couple of the stars. David Alan Greer was nominated for a Tony for his performance as the drug dealer and pimp Sportin' Life. He gets to sing two of the songs that have become pop standards. There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York, and It Ain't Necessarily So. David Alan Greer first became known for his work on the sketch comedy TV show In Living Color. He got a start on Broadway, starring in a musical about Jackie Robinson, which got him his first Tony nomination. The second was his performance in the David Mamet play Race. Here's Greer as Sportin' Life, trying to convince Bess to come with him to New York and leave Catfish Row and Porgy.
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me, that's where you belong, sister. You and me can live that high life in New York. Come with me, there you can't go wrong, sister. You buy you the swellest mansion up on the upper Fifth Avenue. And through Harlem you'll go strutting, you'll go a-strutting, and there'll be nothing too good for you. You'll dress the rich in silks and satins, just like the pair of stylers. And all the blues you'll be forgetting, you'll be forgetting. There'll be no fretting, just nothing but smiles. Come along with me, that's the place. Don't be a fool, come along. Come along. There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me.
David Alan Greer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Really loved your performance on the show. You know, I interviewed Audra McDonald recently about playing Bess, and she said that, you know, she always loved the song There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York as a song, as a, just an independent song, and always thought, oh, it's about this guy who's inviting a woman to go to New York and lead a more glamorous life. He wants to buy her things. Isn't that great? But hearing it in the show, you know, this guy's really trying to seduce her into a life of prostitution and drug addiction. Yeah. He wants to be her pimp and control her. Did the meaning of the song change for you when you joined the cast and started singing of the song?
Absolutely. My relationship to Porgy and Bess coming into this production was one of, I've never seen the opera. I have sketches of the movie in my head. So remembering those patches of the movie as a child, I thought Happy Dust was like fairy dust. You know, like, is he a magician, Sportin' Life? Is he, what, you know, what exactly is he doing? Because I was too young to really understand who and what this man was, this character was.
What meaning did Porgy and Bess have for you when you were growing up? How aware of it were you?
This whole production has been so strange. I was talking to my brother, my older brother, about Porgy and Bess when we first started. We did a workshop in New York, and he said, "Well, you know, Dan was obsessed with Porgy and Bess," and I'm like, "What?" I'm the youngest of three kids. So I'm 55 now, which means when the movie came out, I was really little. I was like, 3 years old? So I don't have any memory of it. I've never seen the opera. And he goes, oh, yeah, Dad, love. And I'm like, why would he be obsessed with Porgy and Bess? And he goes, well, you know, my father contracted polio on a troop train in Korea. He's a retired psychiatrist. And all of a sudden, it's like this huge thing appears to me. And I go, well, of course, now I understand. He's seen all these productions of Porgy and Bess. And we started corresponding by email, and ultimately came to the show, which was, boom, this was him. In a lot of ways, to have this opera depict this man suffering from polio on stage, in a lot of ways, this was him. This was an aspect of him that he saw, and it became infused with so much more to me.
So you're saying that your father, who had polio, related to Porgy because Porgy is crippled.
Absolutely.
Porgy didn't have polio. Like, he was...
No, but I mean, it's not like he...
I just wanted to make that clear. Yeah.
Right.
So you didn't even make that connection until your brother told you after you started working.
No, because I didn't remember. Yeah, I was a little kid. I did not remember, but my brother's older, and he goes, oh, yeah, when the movie came out, Daddy came home with posters, and he through our correspondences, he talked about all these other productions that he'd seen, the opera, and who's playing Bess, and how are we doing it differently. I mean, he was all involved. But it also helped us all, because, as a child, I never saw my father as anything other than a normal and vital man. You know, he had a severe limp because he caught polio, contracted it on one side. He was in an iron lung. He was in crutches in a wheelchair, and he basically came finally with this brace, which is exactly like the brace that Porgy wears at the very end when he saves up his money and he finally gets this brace for his leg to help him walk. That's what I played with as a kid. I played with his brace in the house, when I was growing up.
Was it a relief to know that your father loved Porgy and Bess? And here's why I ask. Your father is the co-author of a very important, widely read book called Black Rage, which was published in 1968. And it's all about all of the issues like, slavery, oppression, discrimination that held back and pushed down African Americans, and what the source of that day's anger was. And some people see Porgy and Bess as being stereotyped. Some people see it as being this, extraordinary achievement that gave both a Broadway stage and an opera stage to African Americans who would have never gotten such fantastic roles before.
Right.
So did you know how your father, in those two?
I didn't. I didn't know all of that. Because that was the conversation, that's the exact conversation we had when he finally was able, we was well enough to travel to see the production. We went out for lunch, and I said exactly that. I didn't know your relationship to Porgy and Bess, if you felt it was racist or if you felt this was a great American opera, blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he was like, this is, America's greatest opera. Are you kidding me? From my research, when Gershwin first brought this piece to his African-American cast, which he himself insisted only be played by African-American artists, why do I bring this up? Because there's a very famous story. Al Jolson really wanted to play Porgy in blackface.
I was so amazed when I heard that.
Well, it's there you go.
Just thinking what that would have been like, how bizarre that would have been.
Right.
How wrong that would have been.
Right. I mean, we're getting into a lot of the controversy of our production. As soon as Gershwin brought this to this group of African-American artists, the original company got together with him and said, look, we have to cut out these racial epithets. They are offensive to us. And we as artists will not do this. So the piece has always evolved and changed. It changed from there. And then this company said, we will not play in segregated houses. So as they went from Boston to Washington and started that original tour, the company was like, unless you desegregate the house, meaning everyone sits together, it's not going to be done. So there is a lot of history surrounding this piece that's very interesting to me. Quick story. My father has been very ill.
He was
not able to travel to see Race, which I know he would have loved. Why? Because I was a screaming black man. He would have loved it. He finally came to see Porgy and Bess. And I asked Audra and Norm to come out. As they came out, my father grabbed Audra's hand and just began to weep. Members of the company that I'd asked came out and surrounded him and hugged him. And he kept telling Audra, "You have made my life so rich." So it was a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I'm so glad that he got a chance to see Porgy and Bess.
God, that is really moving.
Oh, it was great. It was great.
So you're not an opera singer, but in Porgy and Bess, the character of Sport and Life is usually not always, but usually often not an opera singer. He's been played by Cab Calloway, by John Bubbles, by Sammy Davis. Did you feel like you were up for, a singing role? I know your first role on Broadway was in a musical about Jackie Robinson with you in the leading role. But I presume it's been a while since you sang seriously on stage?
You got to sing. I mean, Diane put me in the room. I sat, Philip Boykin would sit behind me and he would sing my parts. We started with the most difficult Killing of Robins, which is this so vocally and musically challenging. I was totally lost, but he said, "Look, you can do this. It's fine. It's wonderful." It was very challenging, but you just jump in. They cast me. Someone believed in me.
Wait, the Killing of... I'm trying to remember what you sing there.
Well, the Killing of Robins is when Crown comes in the very beginning of the opera, and he kills Robin. So, there's a crap game.
Yeah, right.
We get in a fight.
Right.
Well, vocally, there's all this counterpoint. You wait 12 bars on the flatted fifth. David, you come in. You hold this note. Once you go out, you count another 7 measures. You come in. Oh, with all these vocal things. It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. But... so we're all working on this stuff. We work for a few weeks. We put it together, and it's so intricate. Funny, at the end of the day, Diane goes, "Look, we're gonna clear this up." And she cut my parts. It was in the staging. And I very gallantly said, "If you insist, I will adhere to your artistic choice." But inside, I was like, "Thank God. I don't have to sit there and count." But I'm telling you, it was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh.
Right.
Kill him. Is he dead? Oh. Crown is very drunk. He's very, very, very drunk. Oh. And so, and running around the stage, I never got the part right. And I would stand behind Mingo, and he would, if he turned his face right, I could copy off of him like a kid in school. I could see where we were supposed to come in because his part was the same as mine. And so, it was wild. It was wild. But we got through.
Well, let's hear something that you are in. Let's hear one of the most famous songs from the show, It Ain't Necessarily So, which is Sport and Life song, and set the scene for us. This takes place at a picnic on a little island that all the people from this little fishing village are there. Bess is there. Porgy has stayed home. And you're kind of like preaching a sermon, and it's a pretty religious community. So set the scene for this song.
All right. Well, part of, and on the picnic, it's very pivotal for Bess because she is being integrated and accepted into this community. A formerly scorned woman, the women of the community have invited her out and they're embracing her. You're with Porgy now. You are one of us. As in every community, there's a very religious person there who's admonishing everyone, don't drink, don't gamble, you should all be in church. You remember that, this is how we're supposed to live as good Christians. And what motivates the song is Sport and Life making fun of her, making fun of Serena. Like, yeah, right, that's not the way it is. It's not. This is garbage.
Okay, so we're going to hear this. This starts with Serena, and then, Sport and Life comes in right after. David Alan Greer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Remember, children,
At the end of the day, like the Bible say, you reap just what you sow.
You reap just what you sow.
That's right.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so.
Won't you tell us more?
Now little David was small, but oh my.
Little David was small, but oh my.
He fought big Goliath, who lay down and died. It ain't necessarily so. Swadu,
Swadu,
Azimbembilu,
Zimbembilu,
Kudladawada,
Kudladawada,
Skandiwa,
Skandiwa.
That's David Alan Greer from the cast recording of the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess. Our interview was recorded in May. The final Broadway performance of Porgy and Bess is September 23rd. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Yowei Shaw is doing our online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.